So, without further ado, assuming everybody has a beverage and is settled and relaxed in their delightful plush red chair, let me introduce tonight two titans who are going to take the stage. So first we have Jonathan Metzl, who's the Frederick B. Rentschler II Professor of Sociology and Psychiatry and the Director of the Center for Medicine, Health and Society at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. He received an MD from the University of Missouri, a psychiatry internship in residency, as well as an MA in Humanities and Poetics from Stanford University, and then has a PhD in American Culture from the University of Michigan. I first encountered Jonathan's work in his first monograph, Prozac on the Couch, Prescribing Gender in the Era of Wonder Drugs, which I heartily recommend to anyone interested in psychoanalysis, gender, and obviously antidepressants. He's edited the fantastic collection Against Health, How Health Became the New Morality. And he was last in Durham a few years ago as a guest of the then Center for Medical Humanities, lecturing on his 2010 book, The Protest Psychosis, How Schizophrenia Became a Black Disease. Jonathan's most recent book, Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland, has taken America by storm, and he's been widely covered across the media on MSNBC, CNN, NPR, PBS, I love the acronyms, The New York Times, The Washington Post, Vice, Vox, and a range of other different outlets. He's been a very, very, very busy person promoting the ideas raised in the book and encouraging discussion across the land. In April, his presentation for the 2019 National Anti-Racist Book Festival at the Politics and Prose bookstore in Washington was disrupted by a group of about 10 white nationalists. We're delighted that this is Jonathan's first public appearance in the UK since the publication of Dying of Whiteness. But we hope very much that there will be no such derailing of the full and frank debate we hope to have here tonight. Joining us as a participant in that debate and as a key provocateur, I'm sure who's known to many of you, is Professor Danny Dorling, the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford. He also holds visiting and adjunct professorships at Goldsmiths, University of London, the University of Bristol, and the University of Canterbury in New Zealand, and has a very strong connection to the Northeast, having completed his undergraduate and postgraduate degrees at the University of Newcastle. In his PhD, The Visualization of Spatial Social Structure, completed in an amazing 2 years, Danny developed a new technique to map social and demographic data in unprecedented detail. And ever since the publication of his first Social Atlas in 1995, he's been building up an extraordinary picture of poverty and wealth, among many other factors, in contemporary Britain. According to a profile on The Guardian, Danny is that rare kind of academic, expert, politically engaged, and able to explain simply why his subject matters, because matter it does. He is one of Britain's analysts, foremost analysts of inequality, and a prolific writer and commentator on its impacts and effects in politics, housing, education, and health. He's the author of Injustice, Why Social Injustice Still Persists, The Equality Effects, Peak Inequality, Britain's Ticking Time Bomb, and most recently, Rule Britannia, Brexit and the End of Empire. So we've come together tonight to explore all the recent publications of these two prodigious thinkers and commentators, and to think about the question collectively, why is it that people vote for politicians and endorse rhetoric which actually puts their own lives at risk? And what is it that we can do about it? So, Jonathan, take it away.
Thank you so much. It's really such an honor for me to be here. And I just want to say, first of all, thank you to the Institute for Medical Humanities. That's in part why I'm in town, is that we've spent the last 2 days working on this, really, the question of what are the medical humanities and how can we bring politics and health and questions of health and healthcare to bear in ways that matter not just within the ivory tower of an institution, but also in engagement with community. And it's wonderful to see the Institute hosting events like this, really an honor. It's also just, I have to say, a spectacular setting. And so it's great to speak here. And I'm also a big fan of free wine before I ever speak. So people will say, well, whatever, but God, we got a couple of free drinks out of the whole thing. So thank you so much. As Angela just mentioned, I've been really almost unexpectedly on this very interesting journey since, and I'll tell you a little bit about in my talk today, since the book first came out, which is about 2 months ago. And since that time, my publisher initially thought, oh, this is just going to be a small topic that not a lot of people are going to care about. And it turned out the minute the book hit, it addressed this question that I think a lot of people have in the back of their minds, which I'll be telling you about in a moment here, which is, why do people seem to vote against their own self-interest? Why are people voting for politicians who might be upending their own healthcare, their own schools, their own, safety, if you're going to add a lot of guns to a community? And so, in a way, that question, I think, in part hit a nerve. Right? A lot of people were wondering that same kind of question, and it became more complicated than I think people were expecting. And so I did a lot of media. And then I will also say that this thing happened with the white nationalists, which was quite an interesting experience. It was terrifying for a moment. And then my book went crazy, went to number 9 on Amazon, and all my friends were calling me and they're like, how can we get some Nazis at our talk or something like that? They should have their own literary agency or something like that, because they really are brilliant. But I will say that that question of why do people vote against their own interests and what is rational in a moment that feels irrational is something I think that connects at least the rhetorics of what's happening in the United States and Brexit. And I just want to put this slide up as a disclaimer, right? Because I don't know the answer to that. I will say that there's a lot of coverage in the United States right now about the parallels between the United States and Brexit, and it has to do with like a crazy leader, a charismatic leader, people doing things that might not be good for their own economy but might matter otherwise. But I have to say, I kind of have a problem with this framing, even though, of course, Trump himself and Trump's son are going around saying it's exactly the same thing as Brexit, but it's really not, right? It's not for a bunch of reasons. One is that rationality and irrationality mean very particular things in very particular contexts. And the other is because of work that Danny's doing right now, which has to say that there are very particular histories of these movements that seem to be rational in some ways and irrational in other ways. And I think Danny's book that is out on the table out there really talks about the ways that you can't understand Brexit without understanding the history of the United Kingdom, the history of empire, the history of the ways that social and socioeconomic class have played out in the United Kingdom. And I think that's very important, and it's something you should really think about when you think about just making some easy parallel between Trump and Brexit. And in a way, that creates, I think, a good lead-in for my own work, because my own work basically argues that even though Trump is a particular phenomenon in the United States, that you can't understand Trump without understanding many different histories of what's happened in the United States about individualism, go it yourself, all these kind of things. But also, for me, I'm a scholar of race, about the history of race in the United States. And so part of the reason that I try to push back on that question of why do people vote against their own self-interests, there's an assumption in that very question, which is you understand what their interests are. You understand that they might want this thing, healthcare, schools, blah, 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 blah. But it turned out, over my research, I found that wasn't the case, that there were very different cases and that people were not uninformed about what Trump was doing. Instead, they knew the decision and they were choosing it. For me, that really has to do a lot with many factors. But the key that I want to talk to you about tonight is about the history of race in the United States, because that question of why do people not support their own self-interests has been at the fore of the ways we think about race really for the last couple hundred years, at least in the United States, which is, is about as old as our country is. And part of that has to do with really race and socioeconomic class. And the reason I bring this up as a framing rhetoric is to think about the work of W.E.B. Du Bois, a famous theorist in the United States, who was writing a book about the period after the Civil War. And basically his argument in his book, it's called On Reconstruction, in the period after the Civil War. The point is, we just had this terrible war in the United States that's really about race and slavery and a bunch of other factors. And then after the war, it created different groups of people who were really poor and really not doing very well. And one group that were doing very poorly were white laborers, right? They had no rights, they didn't own any land, they had no control over their wages, over their working schedules, because all the power was in the white landowning elites. And there was another group of dispossessed people, and those people were freed black slaves, right? These freed slaves themselves, of course, had no rights. They had freedom for the first time, but they didn't have any land, they didn't have any property, they couldn't set their own wages. And so Du Bois asked this question in his book about Reconstruction: why is it that the low-income whites and the newly freed slaves don't join in common cause? Because these are the people who are tending the fields, right? And if they all join together in common cause, they could extract all of these privileges from white elites. They could say, we're not going to work unless you give us better wages, give us a chance to own land or something. So the question Du Bois asks is, why don't these two groups get together? And the answer that he gave is because he coined this famous phrase, the wage of whiteness, which is, you hear this about this a lot. But the idea is, in the American context, that lower income whites were given a wage, that in a way it meant something, not financially, but psychologically, to be white. This was something that was given to them by the upper class whites. And this wage was so powerful that it set them apart from African Americans who were not, you know, who might have had their same interests. And so his argument basically is, whites continue to defend this wage, this psychological wage of what it means to be white, even when it's not in their own self-interest. And that became my frame for writing this book, because part of what I argue is that the wage is not just psychological, it's also a biological wage. And so with that, I'll tell you two stories of how I came to this particular project, which link to this question of the wage of whiteness. Number one is that, you know, like much of the rest of the world, the United Kingdom has a functioning or quasi-functioning healthcare system where people have health insurance and coverage and can go to the doctor when they get sick. That's not exactly the case in the United States, and we have very low rates for industrialized nation of healthcare coverage. And in about 2010, the Obama administration finally got the, you know, blessing of Congress and the Senate. And what they did was came up with this act called the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act, as I'll tell you in a minute, a little about it, it was going to increase the level, at least the level of basic health care coverage that the citizens have. Now, I'm living in Tennessee. I had just come to Tennessee. And that question of health insurance really was important in a state like Tennessee. This is our state flag. And the reason is severalfold. Number one is that Tennessee is a state where, in the United States context, most of the health insurance companies are located in Tennessee, and there have been various attempts over the course of the history of the state to use that health insurance industry to provide coverage for people in the state of Tennessee, where I live. And so there was a big movement, something called 10Care in the 1990s, for example, where government and private industry all got together and they said, nobody has health insurance in the state where all the health insurance is, so let's get together and do this thing called 10Care. And what they did is they thought, this is going to be this great program. We're going to manage all of these people. We're going to create a cost-effective way to deliver quality health insurance to people in our own state. And really, what happened was, this was seen as a national reckoning, right? People thought, oh my gosh, if a state like Tennessee can create a functioning healthcare system, then any place, including in the South, the South of our country has very low health insurance rates, that would be a great thing. So initially, there was a lot of interest. A lot of people got coverage. I can show you down here that we rose to 94% of healthcare coverage in the state, a very diverse state. So in the United States, that's pretty much remarkable. But unfortunately, what happened quickly after that was that the costs got to be too great. And why did the costs get to be too great? They got to be too great because there were a lot of really sick people. What happens when you have a population of people who haven't had health insurance for 30, 40, 50 years? When they join the system, they're not gonna come in and say, like, doc, I want a physical. They're gonna come in an ambulance, right? Or they're gonna come in their first encounter and say, I need, you know, triple valve replacement surgery or something like that. So there was a lot of unmet medical need. And it turned out that the cost got so high that at the end of the 1990s, the entire program collapsed because we couldn't afford the system, basically. And it got to the point where there are articles in the paper now where people who don't have health insurance, they have to spend like 3 or 4 days on the phone just redialing, just to get a basic operator pickup, to get even something as simple as a prescription. So part of the issue of why Tennessee is important in terms of health insurance is because this great attempt to give the citizenry health insurance, and it failed. Another reason that my home state of Tennessee is important is because, I'll use a medical term, we have really crappy health in our state. And so every indicator, including obesity, overdose, chronic disease, infant mortality, these are all terrible in our state. And in the aftermath of that failed program, around the time that the Affordable Care Act came out, we were seeing rising rates of uninsurance. And what happened ultimately is that the state fell into very, very poor health. We have now a 70% obesity rate, and all these chronic medical problems that are really a healthcare crisis in the state that wanted to give people health insurance. And so that's the framework in which all of a sudden here comes this thing called the Affordable Care Act. Now, I realize it got different maybe kinds of coverage in the United Kingdom, but for us, the Affordable Care Act was important for a number of reasons. It wasn't perfect in its first iteration. Most social policy isn't. I like to think of it as like your very first iPhone or like Atari Pong, the very first, that's dating myself, I guess, but very old video games or something like that. In its first iteration, the Affordable Care Act gave free preventative care. And that's important, right, in a place like Tennessee, because people are not gonna need to go to the doctor when they're sick. They can go to prevent sickness, right? That's really important. It gave public health prevention, so the issues aren't not just taking place in the clinic, but also out in the community, anti-smoking, anti-obesity, all these factors. It gave consumer protections, and which is really important because what insurance companies were doing is they were kicking sick people off the rolls, right? If the minute you got a chronic illness, you couldn't have insurance, and so you couldn't do that anymore, right? All of a sudden, and remember, Tennessee has all these really sick people, and it covered low-income people who were the majority of the people who didn't have insurance. So just, if we just landed from Mars, and I told you about the Affordable Care Act, you'd be thinking like I think, that the Affordable Care Act for a place like Tennessee really was manna from heaven, right? It was, oh my God, this thing is coming in, and it's addressing exactly the problems that we have, right? Uninsurance, low, you know, poor health in the community, all these factors. Now, unfortunately, that's not exactly what happened. Instead, what happened was they announced this Affordable Care Act, and there are all of these protests by people who are saying, get your hands off my health care, stop spending, people were rejecting. Now, the irony, of course, is many people didn't have health care, so you couldn't put your hands on their health care because they didn't have it. But a lot of this was done in very racial terms. So there were a lot of these posters that went around, for example, comparing Obama to a black witch doctor, an African witch doctor. So incredibly racist undertones. And this set the framework for the research that I did in the book to read off the book, which is colleagues of mine and I from Vanderbilt University went to a series of low-income housing projects outside of Nashville in very rural parts of Tennessee, and we talked to different groups of men. We talked to men with chronic medical illness, very sick a lot of times, in need of health insurance and health and community coverage. These are stock photos. These aren't our research subjects, but it kind of gives you a flavor of the kind of people that we were talking to. And we wanted to know about the Affordable Care Act, right? I guess the premise of the book, of the research was, this is the year 2010, 2011, 2013. And we wanted to know, gosh, you know, you might be a Republican or Democrat, you might feel a certain way about Obama or the government, but here's a program that's gonna give you guys healthcare, right? A lot of these people didn't have healthcare or they were on very poor plans. And I guess the thought was, here are people who, you know, if you have chronic liver disease or chronic lung disease, something like that, that's gonna be the moment where you're, we thought presumably gonna be like, forget our political ideology, we just want the healthcare. So let me just tell you a little bit about what happened. First of all, we heard stories of remarkable bravery. We did two sets of groups. We did about 30 groups in all. One set of groups was with African-American men, and one set of groups was with white men. And what we found, first of all, is that if you're poor in the United States, you just really have to fight really hard just to get very basic. You have to fight to survive. And that was in no short order because people were very resilient. So I don't want to take anything away from that. But again, I'm a race scholar. And so I just want to point out one point about what happened, you know, in the groups that became the jumping off point for the book, which is we asked a bunch of different questions, and, you know, to lead off, we asked, what do you do to stay healthy? What kind of things do you do to take care of yourself? And in a way, what we found was that there were very similar answers between white and black men. They all said, gosh, I feel great if I walk by McDonald's and I don't go in and get a Big Mac, factors like that. But then after about 20 minutes of the group and we kind of chit-chatted, we would ask them a question, who benefits from healthcare reform? And this is a kind of loaded question, right? Because we're not saying, do you benefit or what's your sense of it? We ask, who benefits from healthcare reform? And what we found when we talked to black men was pretty remarkable. They all said, everyone benefits. That was pretty much across the board, the answer that we got from the African-American men. Everybody gets it, everyone as a society. It doesn't just protect us, it protects the citizenship. And that was really across the board, the answers that we got in the Black group. And in a way, that makes sense if you think about it. That's how health insurance works, right? The most people that buy into a system, the more people that benefit. So that's the kind of mentality that you want people to have. If you want to create a healthcare system, because the sense is, I might be well, that person might be sick, but if we all buy into the system, we're all gonna do better in a way. When we asked white men, nobody, I'd say, gave an answer like this. Instead, the answers were pretty remarkable. People said, I'm 53, I've had 2 heart attacks, I have a chronic cough, I'm fat, I smoke, my diet soaks, I spend 12 hours a day flipping burgers, I come back to my room, I eat food, I'm a ticking time bomb, and I'm gonna probably die the same way my dad did. And then I'd say, who benefits from healthcare reform? And the person would say, I ain't supporting Obamacare, no way. I ain't signing up for it, neither. Ain't no way I want my tax dollars helping Mexicans or welfare claims. And so this narrative, this powerful narrative, that here's a social program that might benefit me, but I'm not signing up for it, even if I'm the guy who gave this answer actually just had an oxygen cannula. But I'm not signing up for this because it might benefit somebody else. And I can't tell you how often answers like this came up in our focus groups. They go to 2 or 3 doctors, you're serving resources. A lot of people that use welfare and get our jobs, they're using it up. It's about time that we do something to block them. The worst thing that pisses Americans off is that we were pocketing all the Mexicans, all the illegal mother truckers, I use that word now at parties, their houses, their cars, food stuff. So this idea that basically there's a limited amount of resources. And what this is what psychologists call a zero-sum formulation of race, basically. That it's not like we all benefit. It's like there are winners and losers. And if these guys take resources from us, then we're all gonna lose. And so, in a way, that experience became the existential question for me of writing this book, which is really, what were these men dying of, right? Here are these men who are chronically medically ill, these men who need treatment, and they're literally rejecting their own healthcare, not voting for it. And I wanna say that on one hand, and I take this pretty seriously, these men were dying of very serious medical illness. So the things we saw in these groups in rural Tennessee was pretty much every kind of chronic illness, from cancer to liver failure, heart disease, addiction, deaths of despair. And in a way, they were, you know, this medical illness question was important, but they were also, and I hope you can see just from that one example, dying of a particular ideology, right? And an ideology that goes back to that Du Bois notion of the wage of whiteness, that there's a privilege of white Americans, that immigrants and minorities are using up resources that are for us, that we are paying for it. I think there was a fear of leveling the playing field. If there's only so much money and we help everybody, that's gonna be less money for us. And importantly, I think this is kind of the big point. It wasn't just a bunch of men in these little groups that we did. This ideology went hand in hand with a much bigger story, which is that Tennessee voters voted to block the Affordable Care Act in our own state. So what happened was, we live in Tennessee, Kentucky's right next door. Kentucky voted to support the Affordable Care Act, but Tennessee, because of these factors, voted to not have the healthcare expansion. So literally these very ideologies went hand in hand with blocking the Affordable Care Act in our state. And so what I do in the book is I just basically ask, what are the costs of that particular ideology? Let's just assess what those costs are. And I'll just give you a few data examples. One is, I compared Tennessee and Kentucky, and I will say that if your goal is to block the health of African-American or Latino-American citizens, there's nothing like blocking their healthcare that will hurt their health more. So these are stories about rates of uninsurance. And you can see basically that rates of uninsurance for Black and Latino Americans in Kentucky fell dramatically. So the state that did adopt the Affordable Care Act, their Black and Latino citizens all of a sudden got healthcare, but Tennessee, the Black and Latino citizens didn't get healthcare. So if your goal was to block those citizens, it's incredibly, incredibly effective. The only problem was they were also blocking their own healthcare. And so the central story of the book was that factors in Tennessee, like routine office visits in a year, forgoing medical care because of costs, These things all improved dramatically in Kentucky, and they got dramatically, dramatically worse in Tennessee. And I do a lot of data analysis in the book, and I ask, what was the cost, really? What was the cost to the citizenship of Tennessee? And I do a lot of different data analysis, and basically what I found was that every white citizen of the state of Tennessee ended up losing, on an aggregate, about 3 weeks of their lifespan, not because they themselves couldn't go to the doctor, many white people could go to the doctor, others couldn't, but it's because the whole health insurance system of our entire state fell apart because there wasn't this infusion of money coming in from the government. So in a way, the central question of the book is it worth 3 weeks of your life to support this ideology? And I'm not making a judgment, I will just say that that became the jumping off point for my book, which is to go through, and I look basically at other places where people traded off their own lifespan, their own longevity. 5 more minutes, is that okay? Traded their own longevity, their own lifespans. And I looked for other examples where I found basically that this ideology, and particularly an ideology of what it means to be white in the United States, where that story plays out in addition to healthcare. And the other places that it took me to Missouri, the state actually that I grew up in. Missouri is a state that had been very strict in terms of gun laws, and all of a sudden, there was this huge influx of guns, and I'll show you in a minute, there's a race story about why everybody got a gun in Missouri. I also looked at the education system in a state called Kansas. Kansas had a very strong education system, and then the same kind of arguments took place, and people voted in the demise of their own education system. And I'm not trying to call any one person a racist. I make this point very clearly in the book, and every time I speak about it, I don't know what's in anybody's heart. And I think people are complicated, right? We all have conflicted feelings. So it's not like I'm saying those racist dummies or something like that. What I am saying is that there is a particular politics that I've been trying to describe to you, politics that's afraid of government, afraid of immigrants, for guns, and against taxes, all these factors. And when those kind of anxieties ended up setting the state-level health policies, the health of everybody suffered, including the health of white populations who voted for it. So let me give you two other quick examples, and then I'll finish up. I mentioned the state of Missouri. Now, as I mentioned, when I grew up in Missouri, it was really hard to get a gun. You know, you had to go through this whole, as a kid, I did not have a gun. But you had to go through all this process. People had guns for hunting and factors like that, but you couldn't just walk in anywhere and get a gun. And about the time that President Obama got elected, there were these big push to dramatically expand gun rights in the state. And they basically upended every kind of regulation that governed how it was hard for people to get a gun. So all of a sudden, you didn't need a permit, you didn't need a background check, you could just walk into a Walmart and pick up a gun. And what happened when it became very easy to get guns? I will just say this with a lot of data behind me. The first thing that happened is tons of white people in Missouri ran out and got guns. So all of a sudden, we became hyper gun owners. A hyper gun owner is somebody who owns more than 30 weapons. And it turns out that 95% of hyper gun owners in Missouri were white men over the age of 40. So white men rushed out and got a lot of guns. Now, why is that important in race history? It's because a place like Missouri has a particular story about who can own a firearm. And so there is this long history in Missouri of patriots, defenders, citizens. Danny and I were talking before the panel. And what I don't think people realized is definitely rich white people like landowners could own muskets and rifles and all these factors, but they also gave the right to own a gun to poor white people to quell rebellions from slaves who might have wanted to revolt or run away or something like that. So if you carried a gun in Missouri for the last 150 years, even in colonial times, you were a white person. White people were allowed to carry guns and other people weren't. And every time in the history of the United States, the people who were African American and tried to say, oh my gosh, it's my right to have a gun, and people like Frederick Douglass or Malcolm X or the Black Panthers, every time African Americans tried to say, we want to carry weapons as well, it wasn't like, oh my gosh, you're a patriot. It was more like, black people should not have guns. And there's a whole history of this that goes back to representations of guns. And so in the book, for example, I talk a lot about the ways that gun advertisers sell guns using the rhetoric of whiteness and white privilege. So here's an ad for Bushmaster AR-15 semi-automatic rifle. And they literally talk about white male privilege in the ad, trying to sell the weapon. There's also this thing about the armed citizen, restoring the balance of power, basically taking words right out of the history books. And when I went to Missouri to try to tell the story of who was carrying guns, I found that, right? There were a lot of white Americans who were carrying guns in public, going on these parades, walking through stores and shops, carrying these rifles, AR-15 military-grade rifles. But when African American people would try to do that, they would get tackled, they would get assaulted, they would get shot, something like that. So this idea of who could carry a gun in public was really a story about race. And I have much, I could talk for hours, and I won't because I'm going to finish up in a second here, but I could talk a lot about this question of what happens when you add a lot of guns to society. And partially what happens is I went down to the southern Missouri, and people told me, this is our right. We have Second Amendment rights. It's great because now we can defend ourselves against a tyrannical government. But lo and behold, I found a very similar story to what was happening in healthcare, which is on one hand, when you add tons and tons of guns, the number of guns in Missouri went up by about 60 or 70%. There are more homicides, that's certainly true. But the other untold story I found was that the biggest rise in gun death in Missouri after 2008 was rise in suicide. That suicides were 2/3 of all gun deaths. And it didn't really get reported in the media, but even in the United States, 2/3 of gun deaths are suicide. We have about 25,000 gun suicides a year in the United States. And I just crunched the numbers and I asked who's getting shot by these suicides, and it turned out to be 85% white men. So the same groups that are benefiting from this are the groups who are dying of gun suicide. And so in a way, here's this trade-off where somebody's telling you this thing is about your liberty, it's about your justice, it's about this thing. And that's right from their perspective, but I've also really crunched the numbers in the book. And it turned out that basically white men after 2008 were about 15 times more likely to die from gun suicide than from everything else, terrorism, accident, a car crash, all these factors. And so in a way, what was happening was creating this risk factor for white men. I will just say that I did a similar analysis in Kansas. Kansas had this great public school system. And then they started cutting away taxes and cutting away money, and it eviscerated the public school system. It went from number 4 in the United States to number 46 in terms of science and reading proficiency. And I asked people, why is it that you're supporting cuts to your own schools? And people gave me a bunch of different answers, but one was, people told me again and again, we don't want our tax money going to minority school districts because blacks are just using the money to buy party buses. Like, I called the black district and I'm like, do you guys have any party buses? And they said, we do, we can barely buy textbooks. I have no idea what you're talking about. But there was this urban myth. And of course, there's a whole history of education in the United States and in Kansas. And again, I found a similar story, which is that when you cut education, what happened was that African-American 4th and 8th grade reading went down, Hispanic, Latino 4th and 8th grade reading and science went down, but also white students went down. And so in a way, what happened was there was this dramatic undercutting, and I do, again, a lot of data in the book, and I just show the effects of what happens when you undermine the healthcare system. What happens is more people start dropping out of high school, and dropping out of high school in the United States shortens your life expectancy by 8 years. So I just crunched the numbers, and it turned out many more white Americans were being harmed by these policies than were the other groups. The same thing with Tennessee. So let me just say a few points in conclusion. I mentioned before that there are different logics at play and why people might vote against their own self-interest, and one is, people I talked to didn't see this as being against their own self-interest. I mean, many people actually felt like, I'm on the winning side, right? Trump has promised something to us. And I said, well, look, you're losing your health care, you're losing their education. They said, yeah, but you don't understand. There are things that matter more to us. We care more about our candidate, our values, blocking abortion, blocking all these other factors. And so it wasn't like anybody I talked to didn't know what was happening. People were very, very well educated. But the metrics they used were very different from the ones I use as a physician. And so, you know, part of the argument I make as a physician was that on one hand, they felt like they were winning, but in a way what happened was they were creating risk factors, right, that were shortening their own lifespans. And I think probably the most explosive, what's gotten the most press about this, is basically what I show in the book is that these risk factors, voting in a politician who's gonna cut your healthcare, cut your education, all these factors, it ended up being a man-made risk factor that was as dangerous to people as asbestos, secondhand smoke or not wearing seatbelts in their cars, it literally became something that made whiteness itself a negative health indicator. And part of the story is that this didn't just happen in Tennessee, Kentucky, and Missouri. It became the foundation for policies that Trump is now using across the entire country. And my last side, I just want to say that I think there are certain lessons of doing this kind of analysis. And one really is that we're all connected. There might be a fantasy that, gosh, I can cut a healthcare system that's gonna help me but screw over the other guy. But it turns out if you're gonna screw over the other guy, you're probably gonna screw over yourself if you're talking about social programs. And so this idea, you know, either we're all gonna build infrastructure together or we're not, but the idea that basically I'm gonna be safe in my bubble but the other person's gonna get hurt, it does not work that way, especially when you're talking about large government programs. So partially, there's this myth because the people I talked to, they still wanted healthcare, right? They just didn't want it going to the other people. And, you know, I get a lot of pushback, obviously, from the right wing, like those protesters, and they say, you know, this or that, and I just keep saying, let's use health as a metric. Show me one example of something like cutting healthcare that actually is good for people's health, and I have not gotten an answer for that factor yet. And so partially that's it. And I still think, you know, of course there are winners and losers, but I think it leads to this broader question, as I hand the floor over to Danny, this broader question of kind of, you know, what are we gonna do about this? How do we convey these particular messages? So, which seems to be a lead in to the questions of Brexit. But thank you.
Thank you so much. It's great to try to follow on from that. I normally have it far easier because I'm normally not following a description of what's going on in the United States, and I talk about what's coming here, but in some ways we should count our blessings. And I've learned a lot already tonight. We tend to be self-centered. I assume that the right to bear arms was the right to defend yourself against the British. We burnt down the first White House, in case you don't know, and we don't think we're very important. I assumed Americans needed to bear arms in case we came back to take back what was ours. Nothing to do with that. It's about controlling black people. Always has been. Voting against our own interests over here. We have been. We've been doing it for quite a long time. If you go back to the 1980s. Quite a few of you can maybe remember the 1980s. We voted for a government repeatedly, 79, 83, 87, even 92, which saw policies introduced which made our health not improve at the same rate that health improved elsewhere in Europe. If you were to look at the best of 40% of people who were the people most likely to vote for that government, very few people around here did. I was in Newcastle at the time. A donkey would have won with a red rosette in the 80s. The people, the 40% who voted for the Conservatives in the 80s and the 90s, actually most of them didn't do okay out of it. But they kind of thought they had a chance. And they wanted a government that would look after you if you were lucky, if you got money. You could spend it on the holidays rather than having it taxed away. And I think that's quite an important thing about understanding people are not stupid, they're making rational decisions. In particular, in this context in Britain, they're making a decision often when they vote for lower taxes, and we have some of the lowest taxes in all of Europe, to take a risk. Because odds on, you won't need that intensive therapy unit bed. Odds on, you won't get a kind of cancer that's really expensive. I'm told you'll be okay. As a group, yes, it would benefit you to be more magnanimous. But personally, it might be worth taking a risk. The kind of shock horror figures from last week. Infant mortality in this country is falling almost everywhere else in Europe. It's certainly not rising 4 years in a row. 2014, 3.6 babies per 1,000 were dying in England and Wales. 2015, 3.7, 2016, 3.8, figure that came out last week, 3.9. Highest in Western Europe, only place it's rising. You would kill for figures as low as 3.9. There's no state in the United States that's as good as us. Gordon Brown used to go over every summer holiday to the US I think, you know, officially he went over to look for policy ideas, which is not really the right way to go. But also I think he kind of went over because he could feel good about himself when he came back. I'm going to just click through the slides and not say anything about them. They're there for people who get bored easily and can read really, really quickly. 2012 is when we started getting news stories about privatised healthcare beginning not to work. There's a question about what's kind of been happening, what's really been going on. Life expectancy is falling. Rather than talk about life expectancy falling, we debate whether it is or not. 2014 was the highest life expectancy for both men and women as published by ONS, admittedly published by accident. They like to publish them over 3 years. If you were paid by government directly and they could cut your budget, would you release the figures every year that shows how badly they're done? Anyway, life expectancy has fallen since 2014. Millions of years of life have now been lost, the projection to from worse. Private pension funds have taken $300 billion off their liabilities, the money that they will not have to spend in future. The private pension funds are not using ONS data, they're using the death records of their own customers who are dying faster. And of course, I won't ask you who's got a private pension, but generally better off people don't have the private pension. And there's this question about, you know, what is going on? We're in a funny, how about the picture of Jeremy Hunt? Really interesting choices. It's like one of those party games. You know, what is it, Snoggle Dale, that kind of thing. Boris or Jeremy. The health secretary, who appeared to care less than any other health secretary since we had a health secretary, about people dying. I think that was an unfair statement about Jeremy. Or the somewhat irresponsible man. It was a brilliant, brilliant thing to have an argument with your girlfriend so that people don't talk about your personal life anymore. She works in PR, by the way. 2013 was when we first saw things going on in this country. These pictures are from 2014. They're showing social care visits absolutely plummeting. Visits that people didn't think were very useful turns out to be useful. First drop in life expectancy was for elderly women. Around about 2012, elderly women differ from elderly men because the elderly man tends to have a slightly less elderly woman with him. Because as generally men die 5 years earlier, men in the past tend to marry a woman who is 5 years younger. For all elderly women, marry a young man. I was like, if you're going to marry a man at all, marry a young man if you're female. On their own, and you really need to welfare state when you're on your own. This is July 2011. That's target 1A of the NHS, avoidable healthcare, flatlining. It's been a long time. This is not a sudden news about things going wrong in this country. The cause was apparently the flu. Special British flu, red, white, blue flu. Kind of flu that you can't pick up in the body test flu. I think they've almost stopped saying it's the flu. The flu and cold winters. Do you want to know how cold the winters have been? Do you want to guess which periods has had the longest series of the hottest winters ever? 2010 was cold. Before, anyway. Climate change. Useful for helping disprove people lying about cold winters. The flu was blamed by Macmillan in 1953, when he was housing minister, for those people dying in London. The flu is an old one that they use. The NHS, the privatised parts of it, is beginning to get privatised, put advice up on the web for elderly people, telling them what to do. I have too many of these slides. Too much going through. I'm going to click forward a little bit. And it's cock-up. Tomorrow, the mid-year estimates will be released. The mid-year estimates are by far the most important statistics about demography we get. They're released this time of year, every year. Okay, last week or so of June. They tell us how many people died between June, in this case it'll be June 2017 and June 2018. How many people were born, the babies, how many people came in, and how many people left, how many people moved around. And that allows us to work out death rates. So tomorrow, I'll be sitting on the train going back to Oxford with my Excel spreadsheet, working out whether death rates have gone up or down and how much for who. The worst ever mid-year estimates came out on the 23rd of June 2016 to plan. Timetabled. Something else happened on that date in 2016. There was a referendum. The result was a little bit of a surprise. The media was full of that result, and so the fact that 52,000 more people had died than we thought would have died didn't come out. The fact that death rates were beginning to rise very, very rapidly in 2015 as a result of deaths that had occurred in the 12 months around then wasn't noticed. Perhaps if the referendum hadn't been that day, but maybe not. This is what flu epidemic looks like. Short, sharp, 5 weeks in, 5 weeks out, lots of deaths. Not spread out every year. They kind of happen every 10, 15, 20 years. No, it's not flu. Oh, and they spread to other countries. It's not flu. How does 2015 rank? We've been counting deaths since 1832. Well, the worst year we had was 1918, the flu pandemic. The second worst year was 1940, Luftwaffe, the bombing. 1929 was really cold. That was a bad year. There was a great frost in 1895. And so that resulted in a big rise in deaths in that year. 1846, if you know your John Snow, was a cholera year. And 1849 was another cholera year until they took the handle off the pump and actually worked out it was the sewage. And then 2015, that's your ranking. Collecting statistics every year, most detailed statistics on health in the world since 1832. Seventh year. Turns out nobody is responsible for doing anything about it. It's not actually written into any statutory bodies that they actually have to look at the numbers and shout fire. They have to produce all the statistics. We have four chief medical officers. Do they have to say anything when this happens? Not a dicky bird. It's all very complicated. Are you sure you know what might be causing it? We ask the population what's going on. David Cameron announced a happiness index when he became Prime Minister. You'll remember that. You'll never remember the results of it being announced. It's collected by ONS every year. Whole bundle of statistics that didn't make much sense, but at the heart of poor health statistics, that health is by far the most important thing in your life. You are very lucky if you don't know this. It's not just your own health. In fact, people are not that bothered necessarily about their own health. Health of people you love really matters, particularly if they're your grandchildren, and then your children. We asked people 2010, because of David Cameron's request, 2011, 12, 13, about their health, were they satisfied? And the thing plummeted down. People were saying, my health's getting worse. We looked at that and went, they're lying. I showed professors of epidemiology this, and they say, it's an artifact. Whenever you see something like that, they've changed the wording of the question. And it was a little wording question, but anyway. Turns out they weren't lying. Turns out we asked people what's going on. They said their health's getting worse and they started dying faster. Here are the kind of graphs about how big the increase in death was. That's absolute, mainly affects the elderly, middle class, because you don't get to be 85, 89 unless you're middle class on average. Think back to who these people might have been in 79, 1983, 1987, and who they might have voted for. And who's then not getting the meals on wheels, and who doesn't get the adult social worker, and who can't use the bus to get to a hospital because the bus service has been cut and they can't drive anymore because eventually you all can't drive. Here's the relative rates, and what's fascinating about the relative rates, and the thing we're looking out for tomorrow, is this is 25 to 29 year olds. Why didn't it go up for 25 to 29 year olds when everybody else's mortality rates were rising in this country? 25 to 29 year olds were the largest group of immigrants. 60,000, too many, spread out. 60,000 came in from Europe. Annoyingly young, fit and healthy. The interesting question for tomorrow will be how many people have not come, and in particular, how will that affect our health? Because we know the kind of people who used to come when we were a little bit welcoming. We invited them in 2003. And they tended to be very helpful, very cheap to employ, very fit, very healthy. The kind of country they were coming to is this country. There's the black line. We tend to be a low spending country, about 37% of GDP back then, 2002. There's the US, 36%. And once you take into account how much the US is spending, this is public services, on weapons and 10 fleets around the world, it's lower. We're quite good at spending on weapons too. There's our spending, that was the Iraq War. So labour goes up a bit. This is bailing out the banks, this is austerity. We're going to 36% of GDP on public services. You might vote Labour. We have the most radical manifesto. We did at the last election, we're probably going to get it again. Labour manifesto promises to spend 38%, just under there, there to there. That's our scope of our politics. There's the USA. Ireland cheat. We don't need to go into that, but essentially, if you allow Amazon, Facebook, and everybody else to do their accounts in Dublin, your GDP shoots up. So Ireland is not quite as bad as that. Why did Ireland do that? They followed George Osborne's advice about bailing out the banks. It was very, very bad advice. Anyway, Ireland is in an interesting situation. Let me put my Republican hat on for a moment. Those idiots who think you can have a big government. In Finland, people are living in wooden shacks in the woods, taxing at 57%. The schools are terrible. They don't have any industry. Next, we've got France, 54. Take Germany, 43. Nothing works there. Communist, basically. Well, in a way, it is very different. Merkel's policies, some of Merkel's policies are to the left of Corbyn. Countries on the mainland in Europe are quite different to what we've become. I'm going to wrap up in 5 minutes because we're interested in what you have to say. The Economist magazine produced a predictor, tried to predict after the vote who voted for Trump and what predicted the vote. And what they came up with was that these are counties in the US, the best predictor of Trump getting support was health status changing in a county. The worse the health was getting, the bigger the shift in Republicans and hence the shift to Trump. Financial Times produces a dashboard of the red lines about what's happening in terms of social care, in terms of assault, in terms of teacher recruitment, in terms of hospitals meeting their targets. Male life expectancy initially flatlines across all the countries of the UK. Female life expectancy flatlines and comes down. You can have a look at life expectancy, all European countries and all the states of the United States. Down here is inequality, as measured way back in 1983. And here's life expectancy, heading towards 84 for places like Japan, 82 for Sweden, 83. And these are all the states of the United States. They're really helpful because they make the graph look convincing. If you were to take the US off, it all looks a lot more random. If you take Europe away, this all looks a lot more random. But you put the states of the United States and the countries of Europe together, and Japan's very useful because it's big, different, 130 million people. So this isn't just about small countries doing well. Way down here, we get to Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Arkansas. But we shouldn't be looking at this and saying, well, look, we're doing okay here. We're in Europe. The gap between us and France is very small. I'm a geographer. The gap the other way is very big. When I was born, we had one of the best neonatal mortality rates in the world. I was born in the city of Oxford, a John Radcliffe Hospital, and some of the first baby incubators in the world. My brother, next mum and dad, actually spent some time in one after he was born. He's alive. Got small lungs, he's fine. By 1990, we were seventh in Europe. Not bad, I mean, you can't always be top. This is one problem that US and Britain have to cope with. You can't always be top. By 2015, we'd had the biggest ever fall and we got down to about 19th. Below Croatia, Lithuania, give out the points that you may be more prejudiced about, Portugal. Portugal is. Portugal used to be the basket case of Europe. Infants when I was born were three times more likely to die in Portugal. So when you show this to older medics, they go, what? But look, we're still above, I don't know, Romania, Bulgaria, Latvia. But here's the interesting news for you. They're on 5.6, 5.2, but they're getting better rapidly. Since this was done, 2015, remember, our infant mortality rate began to rise absolutely. That's another four. Right? We're on course, if we follow the great plan, by 2030, us and Romania can swap places. And then, will they start worrying about people from Britain flooding in? We produce diagrams like this about the enormous numbers of deaths that's occurred in a few weeks. These were the weeks in which all routine operations were cancelled across the whole of the NHS. And still, you've got huge increases. We look at infant mortality. Infant mortality going up to rates of 987, Alabama, Mississippi, and so on, down to Colorado, not bad, Utah, not bad. But of course, Europe's down here. And this is, again, inequality, infant mortality. It's not that inequality causes infant mortality, it's not that the baby causes a struggle for its breath and the cord gets round because there's a statistic out there. High inequality means you allow the people at the top to take an enormous amount, and the people at the top take an enormous amount, they do not care anymore about people at the bottom. In fact, they care very much about making sure people at the bottom are at the bottom, because you can't keep all that money at the top if the people at the bottom are going to get into the middle. Because the only way the people at the bottom can get in the middle is if they have some of your cash. Inequality is a brilliant predictor of societies going wrong. It's a brilliant predictor of public health going wrong. It's a brilliant predictor of public transport systems going wrong, or education systems going wrong. And it correlates most with how much the top 1% take. Get the top 1% take down, help ensure that the people who are at the top of your society, and they always are more like people in the middle, and you begin to sort out things better. Let's go through this human face, this Colin Sparrowhawk. He died in the bath in Oxford a few years ago, completely unnecessary. Who's responsible? It's not just Secretary of State for Health. I think anybody who has the word chief in the name of their job title should be. Four chief medical officers. Dame Sally's just done her 10 years for England. Chief executives in the NHS, chief nurse, and so on. I think there should be some degree of responsibility. And of course, most recently it's got worse. This is March 2019. Lucinda and Martin were the Guardian yesterday. Lucinda has spent most of last year running two clinics in Jordan for very large numbers of Syrians. And what she did on the days off as the doctor running the clinics is look at statistics from home. Might about them. Anyway, day four yesterday she was trying to get food from the Guardian. Yesterday she got the article in the Guardian about how it is. But these are the life expectancies going down. Almost at the end. Well, I'll leave that up. I'll stop at that. This is a prayer that the Reverend Paul has been trying to get churches all over England to read out on Sundays. It's a prayer for a time of austerity. It's a prayer for the people who died. And it kind of fits the political thing. There's one really interesting thing about our politicians who've allowed this to happen. I mean, they're not stupid. Do not believe in stupidity, really. Believe me. They know that if you invest less in midwifery services, more babies will die. They've just made a calculation that it's a price worth paying. It's a bit like the 80s around here. Three million unemployment. Why did it get to 3 million? Why was it allowed to stay at 3 million? Some fiddling around with state high, because it was a price worth paying for what they were trying to create, which is putting the great back into Britain. The elderly dying earlier is seen as a price worth paying. The thing that really gets to me, and I think you've got to do it to try to understand the thinking, and there's only a small number of people who are thinking this. 80% of people are pro-social, but about 40% can be fooled into thinking that it's in their interest to do something. The thing that really gets me, I'll leave you on, is in a large town in Britain, we tend to only have a dozen or so intensive therapy beds. Now, if any of you are stupid enough to drink about three or four of those glasses of wine, and then decide you're going to drive all the way back up to Newcastle quite fast, and you have a major accident on the way to Newcastle, but you survive, but you're on a really bad, you know, touch or go, they'll either airlift you from the helicopter to Alec or they'll send an ambulance round and you'll be in A&E and then intensive therapy. There's only 12 beds. What happens if the beds are full? It's not a bed. They'll put you into a substandard bed without three really highly trained nurses doing 8-hour shifts, and your chances of survival, which may already only be 40%, will drop to 10. There is no private A&E. So why do British politicians, who after all are slightly more likely to end up in that circumstance because they're being driven around everywhere, apart from the fact that they're actually targets for some people who do want to kill them, because it's a price worth paying, because the cost of insuring against the risk when the risk is small isn't worth it compared to not having to pay high taxes. It's a different mentality to what most people have. Most people have a mentality that goes, let's sort it out and make sure if the worst happens, I'm going to be covered. But a small group of people, who I think include both the contenders for the leadership of the Conservative Party and hence to be our next Prime Minister, think it's better that as much money as possible is left in private hands. They've been telling their party members that for the last few days. And if it's bad luck, it's bad luck. And until you expose that, but also understand that people will not act rationally in the way that you think is rational. People will, if they've got a bit more, vote for others to have less. And they will tell themselves that they have more because they're special, they're 50, they've worked hard, they look after themselves. Even when you can show it doesn't benefit them. In the case of Britain, the majority of people who died early voted Conservative, I'm fairly sure, in 1979, 1983, 1987. Thank you very much.
I think if nothing else, we're going to get people to drink.
Yes, I think we will drive everyone to the
Everybody's
wine
going to be at the bar.
My goodness, I'm about to burst with questions, but it is not for you to listen to me. I'm sure that there are others who are chafing at the bit to respond in various many ways other than just the gnashing of teeth and pulling of hair to what you've heard in the last hour. A huge thank you to both of our speakers for very thoughtful, sustained, revelatory talks that do a whole lot of interesting work at the level of the kind of presentation and figuration of data and research and analysis, but that's perhaps a conversation for another time. We have a roving mic, and we have an open floor. So who would like to lead us off with a question? Yes, hand up the back.
It's really a finger.
So, that's great, thank you. But I have a question about, maybe a narrative that I felt was kind of missing from the both talks, and it's one that relates back to this idea of especially health being this sort of zero-sum narrative and this idea of there being winners and losers. And I don't know, especially if we sort of frame this sort of society in maybe if I look at things in sort of like the framework of like a back and risk society and growing individualism under a neoliberal politic. I basically want to understand how that we're supposed to work against this zero sum narrative under a system of a capitalist economics that does actually sort of, there are winners and losers in capitalism. Is that not the basic framework of capitalism, that the rich stay rich, the poor stay poor? Is that not how capitalism and how the economic system we're living under continues to function? And I just want to know how we move away from these sorts of narratives of actually something that does correlate between Brexit and Trump, this idea of the stupid, uneducated voter voting for stuff that they don't understand, voting against their own needs, something that's, I think, is a narrative that's quite common in both the idea of Trump voters and the idea of Brexit voters, is perhaps an elite looking down on poor people who are voting to, you know, screw over themselves. How do we move away from that narrative? How do we break from that when we continue to live under a system where there is a winner, there is a loser? You know, meritocracy doesn't exist. How do we go through, like, there seems to be some sort of dichotomy there. How do we look at both things at once? That's a great question.
Wonderful question.
Sorry.
Well, I'll start. I think we're going to have a lot to say about that. Great question. Thank you. First of all, you're absolutely right, right? I mean, it becomes this horrible feedback loop where the more, I'll use your term, capitalism, that we do, the more there are particular winners and losers. And if you think about the ways that, you know, large social programs that benefit people across the board are passed, it's because people at the times that they're passed, in the US it's, you know, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, you know, in the UK it's the healthcare system, factors like that. There's this idea of the bigger whole, like, you know, we're buying into the system, but we're all American, or we're all British, or we're all something. And that doesn't encapsulate everybody, but you're at least part of a group where you feel like there are going to be benefits, even though there are admittedly going to be winners and losers. And what we've seen in the United States is that bigger identity starts to fall apart. It's a very tribal moment, right? It's a moment where people are very atomized. I'm not American. I'm a member of this political group. I'm a member of this racial group. I'm a member of this ethnic group. And so in a way, it's very hard to make this bigger argument in a moment where people are feeling like, number one, it's a very tribal moment, and the more anxious people get, the more people fall back into those tribal identities. And number two, you know, there are bigger stories about diminishing resources. So you can say, oh, everybody benefits, but, you know, just think about, like, climate change, for example. Mm. You know, there are winners and losers in terms of resources right now, in terms of that factor. And so, number one, I just want to agree with you that the question of the counter-argument is incredibly hard, but I also, the point I was trying to make is it creates a feedback loop, because what we're doing is we're doing the exact opposite thing that we should be doing in a moment of crisis, right? We should be, it's kind of like the stock market or something. You should be investing more, not less, or, you know, when you're anxious, not austerity, the opposite of austerity and things like that. But it's hard because there's so much fear and anxiety. But I think that's really the million-dollar question, because it's like, do you reassure people? I mean, for me, like, I get asked a lot when I give my talk, well, what's it going to take to change Trump voters' minds, right? And it's such an interesting, complicated question, because that implies there's a right and wrong, and I'm right and they're wrong. And so I answer that in part by saying, well, they have to realize that you can be Republican and Trump voter, and you can also want better healthcare and schools and benefit, that kind of thing. But that's my answer. For them, it's like, you know, I care more about A, B, or C, race or politics, religion, abortion, whatever, than I do about longevity. So it's kind of like we're using very different metrics in a way. But I guess the frustration is, and I'd be curious to see what Danny has to say about this also, but it's like, I think we need to kind of point out the road we're going on in a particular way, but it's hard because the kind of logic that we're using, which is like health data, is not the main, like in other times in life, falling mortality rate, that would be like, oh my God, national emergency. In the data I showed, I can give you three states, Missouri, Kansas, and Tennessee, where we had a 4-year less lifespan for the dominant group. And instead of saying, let's not do that, because that sure sucks for the people in that state, those became the models for the entire country. So there are different metrics that are being used now.
You have to remember that us in the US are extreme. In most of the world, inequalities are actually falling. Life expectancy is zooming up. Infant mortality is now falling at the fastest it's all fallen in the history of our species. Because in 1 year recently, it fell by 10% in a year. You can't go below 1.5 children. So you're actually living worldwide in some ways in the best of times. There are countries like Japan, which are sitting in capitalism, which have the highest life expectancy humans have ever seen. Number of cars has fallen for 25 years. I think places like Japan are moving beyond capitalism. It's officially called two lost decades of growth. But anyway, I think capitalism is a change, not a state. But we could argue about that one. on the voters, that the first fundamental thing on the voters is actually know who you're talking about. So the majority of Leave voters live in the south of England, where a minority of the electorate lived. 59%, possibly 60% of Leave voters are ABC1 middle class. You can have a whole lot of arguments on the motivation, but we are stupid. We have the worst numeracy ability in the UK, and Europe and USA is worse than us. And these things go circular. You know, the more stupid you get, the easier it is to dupe people, the less they understand. There are countries doing much better. But you go to those countries and they don't boast because they're not like us. The more stupid and unequal they are, the more you want to tell how great you are. And why can't the rest of the world follow a great example? Confronting people isn't the way to do things. That's why I'm really impressed by how you're doing it. I'm a naturally, well, I'm probably not, it's just an excuse. I'm quite confrontational and it doesn't help. A colleague of mine in the States told me how they get their students to learn about this in the States. And the way they do it, and imagine you've got a load of 18, 19, 20 year old students in the States, you set them a task, a project, where they can get a mark, and they're competitive, so they'd like that. And the task is to go to the library and help explain why America has the best health outcomes in the world. That's the task. Why does America have the best infant mortality, the lowest rates in the world? Why do Americans live longer than everybody else? And these are university students. And they accept the task. This isn't Harvard, actually. They accept the task, and then they go to the library, and because they want to get a high mark, they try to write the essay. And then they discover themselves in their own head, rather than somebody like me telling them, that's how you change your mind. Right? We tend to change our mind very rarely. Most of my political beliefs I had got by the age of 16. It's only when you change a core belief you've had that you know you're really, really learning. But this, not confronting people and telling them they're wrong or stupid, working a sideways route through is effective. And it's what the right wing have been using for decades and decades, because they've had a problem for 200 years of how the hell do we get people to vote for this so that we can be richer and most of them won't be. So they're good at it. Whereas progressive politicians are not good at not being direct and honest. Corbyn's terrible at it. He keeps on telling what he really believes. When he was asked to be whether he wanted to be Prime Minister by Jon Snow, he couldn't answer the question seven times because he has this thing about trying to tell the truth. I'm not saying we should be terribly, terribly devious, but don't tell people the opposite to what they believe to their face. They won't believe you. Find out a way in which they can come and discover it themselves and think that they've done it. And it's just much more effective.
Can I just add to that, that there are two important factors that are part of this? I mean, one is, we live in an era where if you're going to engender anxiety, it's a banner moment for engendering anxiety. I mean, I saw this with my gun research where they were able to sell guns by telling people, you know, protect yourself, you know, you're going to get killed, you know, blah, 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 blah. And it turns out our murder rates have been going way, way, way down. But if you're, you know, and social media is super helpful, that the narrative of, you know, engendering the somebody's out to take your stuff or somebody's out to get you is very, very powerful here. At least in my research, every time I did hundreds of interviews for my book, and I was curious about this question, so I would ask people, what would it take for you to vote for somebody other than Trump? 85% of the people gave me an answer that had nothing to do with policy whatsoever. They said, find somebody tougher than Trump. Find somebody who's mean enough that they'll give Trump a nickname that sticks. Everybody, I kept thinking, like, what kind of nickname could Bernie Sanders give to Trump? You know, but so we live in this era where there's social media, anxiety, fear, hope for a dictator, all this kind of stuff. So it's a hard moment for our kind of expertise.
We possibly have time for one more question.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's rapidly.
Can we mush together?
We can try, and we can take a number of questions and see where we go. So, gentlemen here, and then Carla in the second row, maybe another one.
So I hear from Jonathan that people are dying of whiteness, and if I hear Danny right, I think people are dying of ignorance. So I want to put it to Jonathan that in fact, in America, people are dying of ignorance. That's what you're really hearing. And I want to put it to Danny that in fact, if you look at Brexit, people are dying of whiteness and it's fear of immigration.
Very pithily Very perfectly delivered question, thank you. We'll hear from Carla and from Adam, and then we'll see how you wish to respond to
as many questions. Throw them all at us.
My question is linked specifically to the gendered natures of inequalities. Because, John, when I hear you speak, what I hear is a toxic masculinity that bears a very specific response to people's healthcare. And I say that as somebody who comes from a country that hovers perpetually as the most unequal in the world. Every time Oxfam does a report, like, we've increased our 1%ers even more than almost anywhere else, although that probably is increasing. And you speak about gun suicide, which I also think is an interesting term, because it's people killing themselves with guns. Gun suicide kind of sounds like the gun is doing the work. And we also know that there's increases in domestic violence and GBV, and certainly in South Africa, where there's increased inequalities, increased concerns about health, people bear the brunt of that quite differently. And mostly it's female people who bear the brunt of that quite differently. And so I'm also just wondering from both of you what the gender dynamics of these inequalities look like.
A third question to throw into the mix from over here.
Thank you both. I guess I have a question just for Jonathan, but it can lead on from that. So, I mean, we hear a lot of things about racism, things like gender inequalities and these frameworks, and you know, unashamedly said, I'm using race as the kind of rhetorical framework for the book. But I wonder, and you mentioned individualism, which I actually think is probably one of the most significant influences in the American context. But those things, I think we would agree, have not changed. Those are the things that are there, as you said, for at least 200 years. But in Tennessee, you gave us, at the collective level of the state, a change from the 1990s and expanding Medicare to the failure of these policies to voting against these policies. And I would just be curious about that. It looked like it's the last 15 years that there's been this big change, and I'm curious what you think about that change in that state.
Shall I go first?
There
are enormous numbers of people who migration and a kind of racism was the tipping thing for them. You know, and a smaller group for whom sovereignty mattered. And a big group who want a future for their grandchildren. That's their worry. And we have a pattern in Britain. Enoch Powell went out to the Caribbean and to India and invited people to come. His health secretary said, can you come and work in the hospitals and on the buses? And a few years after they came, he then did that speech. We voted for a government who in 2003 issued an invitation along with two other small countries to come. We opened up to the A8 early, they came. And then we did the same as Enoch, and it was just as bad as the 70s National Front, go back to where you come from. The one thing I would never have predicted is it was actually, there aren't many people in the world who are much whiter than us. But we actually managed to be racist to a group of people who were whiter than us and not Jewish. So the ability to be racist to almost anybody, you know, has kind of been proved. It's not there, but you have a very good point. And the irony, complaining about 200 Roma in part of Sheffield. You know, if you want to complain about immigrants, try returning to the city of Oxford when you've been away for 30 years and nobody locals there. The biggest immigrant group in Britain are the English in Wales, who won't even learn the language, buy the houses, and so on. On gender, the effect on women's been twice as big as men so far, because it was those very elderly women on their own at first, but it catches up. I mean, so we see the rise of mortality for men happening 2 years later, and then by the time the 75-year-old women are dying faster, the 85-year-old men are. By the time the 65-year-old women are dying, the 75-year-old men with a lag. Because there's much more care for men, not only their partners, but also their family appear to actually go and help out. And there's bias in the system towards men. The numbers are getting high enough with infant mortality, we'll soon be able to compare male babies and female babies. And men are generally weaker. So one reason why more boys are born than girls is that male fetuses are weaker. So you'd expect to actually see a rise in the mortality of male fetuses. And if any of you want to tweet More or Less, just if you know the BBC programme More or Less, whenever anybody tweets them, Richard Vaden, who's the producer, notices. Because More or Less investigated the rise of infant mortality last year and concluded we couldn't tell what had caused it. It could be an increase in premature babies, a special British increase, unlike the rest of Europe, which meant I spent a week looking at all the tragic statistics on babies born at 22, 23, 24, 25 weeks of gestation, and it ent. But tweet More or Less. It only takes three of you, and he knows, because More or Less need to look into it again. This is part of our problem. In a normal European country, which has half the infant mortality rate that we do, even the slightest blip upward would be seen as terrible, because you see other people like you. And we've managed to learn, somehow, not to see other people in this country like us. And it's this individualisation thing. And how you get that back is tricky. We can look to our past as how we did it, but we're going to have to do it in a different way. In the past, it was wars, particularly two, sending the young to a second unnecessary war, showing that the elite were inept. Brexit and student loans were a pretty good attempt. You know, if I was trying to come up with policies that were not a war, because war's terrible, but were really going to wreck the future of young people's lives, then and get them to bond together and feel part of a generation where they're all in it together and want to take back control, then I think we're currently heading in a good situation to get the young to think that they don't want to be in a dog-eat-dog Hunger Games world, where the 1 in 100 will be okay. And I think that's part of where the hope is just generationally getting this thing through. And we're seeing it in the opinions and the voting behaviour of the young, and finally in them voting again. Because in 2017, the young came out and voted. They stopped in 1991 when we poll taxed them. And that was a very effective way of stopping the young voting. I'm generally optimistic it's going to get better. I don't believe we're going to become an offshore tax haven US state and somewhere for the US private healthcare companies to expand into. But they really, really want to, because where else do you go? If you're a US private healthcare company and you've already sucking as much money out of the citizens of the US as you can, 16% of all GDP, and you're capitalist, so you've got to get bigger and bigger. Where on earth do you sell your really, really bad service to next? And, you know, we're sitting there just waiting for them to take the NHS.
That was what Trump said, right, when he was here?
Yeah, he wants it.
Yeah. Well, I'll make 5 points in 4 minutes, and then we'll wrap up. So the first question, you know, I struggle with this a lot. I made a very conscious choice in the book to try to be as empathic to the people I interviewed as possible. I actually agree with you about the framework of the question, but I don't use the word ignorance in the book because I tried to understand what the logics and frameworks, and I also was quite transparent when I was interviewing people about what I was doing. And they told me, you might think I'm an idiot, but actually you're the idiot because we're winning all the elections and we control the White House, the Senate, the Congress, the Supreme Court. And I had a hard time answering that exactly. And so they said, these are the trade-offs we make to win elections. And so, you know, it was interesting, this question of that, right? It was almost like religious or kamikaze or something like that. They were martyrs in a particular way. Now, I think that logic is completely circular in a particular way, but I was trying to understand that logic. And the only reason I say that, getting back to the very first question, is because there was no amount of education that I could provide about how the negative effects of guns were, or healthcare. There was no tutorial I could give people. I think Danny's exactly right. It was more like challenging them in different ways. But about education, we were just talking two very different paradigms. Theirs I disagreed with, but they did have a point that like my side was losing the elections and stuff like that. So I had to take that pretty seriously. But I think that's really a very, very important question. In terms of gender, I didn't get to it very much in my talk, but there are very interesting gender points. I'll just mention two. One is that guns change the gender dynamic of suicide. Sounds like maybe similar in South Africa, because gun suicide is fatal in 93%, 94%. There's no such thing as a cry for help when you're using a gun. It works pretty much every single time, or if it doesn't, you know, it's worse. Whereas overdose, the previous gender trend in suicide was women overdosing, like Sylvia Plath and things like that, which is fatal in 3% of the time. And so the fatality rate of suicide has been dramatically increased by white men owning guns. And so part of this thing is this death graph has changed the gender dynamics of what suicide is. And nobody in that world uses the term a cry for help. There's no such thing, right? And so in a way, how we think about suicide has been shifted by this gendered message, like I showed you in those ads about restore the balance of power and stuff like that. But I do end the book talking to mothers whose own kids are getting hurt by their own by the austerity measures that were undermining the education system. And I guess for people who have a chance to pick up the book, look at what the mothers say. Some felt like, well, we support Trump no matter what. And others were like, this woman gave me this great quote. We supported these politics when the fires were in the fields, but when the smoke started to get into the house, that's when we changed our mind. And so there was something about mothers whose own kids were getting affected that was different. In terms of this question of Tennessee, hopefully we can talk about it like right after, because I think that question is, I have much more to say, and I think maybe there's a little bit in what I just answered, and I have many more things to say. But basically in the last 15 years, we had a black president as part of the issue, and so they were able to racialize a lot of these conversations. Because if you look at the Affordable Care Act, it was a Republican plan from Massachusetts that was adopted by the Democrats. But I think that Obama as president became this rallying cry for people where they could personify what was happening. And just to be metaphorical, like the slave became the master and tapped into all of these anxieties in the South that were able to mobilize people against a lot of these factors. Two last points. One is just to reaffirm what Danny's saying. I mean, I don't want this in totally to be an us and them narrative. Like, writing this book has made me think a lot about the things I do that are bad for my own health. Ride without a bike helmet, all these kind of factors. And I have gained an appreciation for the power of the narrative. People work hard for their lot in life, right? And if the narrative that's being given is other people are going to usurp what's yours, your work is going for naught, it's a very, very powerful message at this particular moment. And so partially just thinking again about the first question, working back against that is to get people to trust each other a little bit more. And part of the issue is the power of that narrative that black people are going to come take your thing, or immigrants are going to take your thing, or even divisions within just the category of white. But the power of that message, because capitalism creates limited resources anyway, of you might be really poor, but that other guy's going to come take your thing. That's the message that has to be subverted somehow in a more egalitarian thing. And I guess the last point is just I hope we can all just drink a lot more after this.
on that deeply optimistic note, I, on behalf of everybody here, want to thank you so much. It was truly a privilege to have heard either of you independently on any occasion, but there's something about being able to see kind of two minds, two sets of analyses at work in drawing out the parallels, but also the distinctions and differences in your approaches, in the ways that you're tackling what are issues jointly facing the UK, the US, and other parts of the world has been, I think, truly a privilege. And I would not say that at every event that I am lucky enough to chair. So I'm hugely grateful. And I think we've kept the audience, you've kept the audience, more to the point, wrapped. And I'm conscious it's just past 7. So, you know, are now released into the world. But please join me very much in thanking Jonathan Metzl and Danny Dorling for an outstanding